Welcome to the Senate Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs for today, Tuesday, May 25th, 2010. We have four topics on the agenda for today, and we will be taking them in the order they are on the agenda. But before we do that, we have just a couple of introductions. We do not have a new committee member today. We have Sharon Myron, who is job shadowing me today. Sharon is an emergency room physician and a former attorney, and she's very interested in government and politics. So she's here for the day, sitting with us at the dais. And we also have a new committee administrator. Cheyenne, would you like to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about you and your background?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been working at the legislature just during sessions since the regular session in 2009 started out on land use as the administrator. They assigned me to rules during the supplemental session. I'm a member of the bar here and in Colorado, and am an Oregonian. I grew up in Prineville.
Thank you, Cheyenne.
Thank you.
So we're having an informational meeting today. Do I need to gavel again?
No, just open.
Okay. We're going to start with the first topic, which is free trial promotional offers. And our first panel will be Keith Dabanovich from the Department of Justice and Angela Martin from our Oregon. And we did have some consumers who were coming. I don't know if they're here yet. So they will be next if they're here. Welcome. Adam, I'm going to have you come up later.
Oh, later? Okay,
yeah.
Thanks.
Sorry about that. It's my fault.
Good afternoon. My name is Keith Dabanovich. I'm Chief of Staff and Special Counsel to the Attorney General. Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. I'm here to speak a little bit about free trial offers. If you have not received one, you must be living somewhere else and either not have access to the internet, not have mail, or not have a telephone. They are ubiquitous. Free trial offers can range in type and format and intent quite substantially. There is a very good and legitimate business reason for doing them, and not all free trial offers are improper. The materials that we have prepared will help you understand what we're looking at. There certainly are free trial or discounted offers that are perfectly legitimate, that are good for the consumer. They provide the consumer with a discounted product that they may end up paying for over time, such as a phone. And those are perfectly legitimate and can be a very useful thing for the consumer. It allows them to get a product at a much lower cost up front than they might otherwise have to pay. From time to time, there are some companies that make mistakes in those areas, but it's the part of the free trial offer that they offer is a relatively minor part of their business. And hence, we don't have a great concern with those kind of offers. The concerns that we have are more with companies whose primary business objective is the free trial offer and taking advantage of the consumer in that context. In our materials, we describe some of the problems that we've seen, and the areas where we find it most are where there is a, quote, risk-free or no obligation or free trial offer, which changes to a paid subscription with little or no notice to the consumer. You think you're getting something for free, and a month or so goes by, and you've now signed up for the rest of your life for $9.95, and you didn't know that you had. We also have problems with automatic renewal terms in which what are called negative option agreements, and that is that the purchase will continue to be sent to you until you affirmatively cancel the agreement. Now, in the grand scheme of things, that doesn't sound very difficult, but if the method of canceling is quite difficult and you're stuck on hold for 45 minutes to an hour on a long-distance telephone call, that creates a problem for some consumers. And it's not surprising that the method of cancellation is much more difficult than the method of signing up. No surprise. We're also finding, particularly in the internet area, there are what are referred to as pre-acquired account marketing or data pass type situations where a perfectly legitimate business that operates on the internet sells space of banner ads or things of that sort to companies. And when you purchase a product, I won't use a name of a company because I may be wrong, but when you purchase a product, you're not thinking that you're signing up for anything other than that one product that you purchased. But those companies will sell transaction data to the marketing company that has the banner ad, and it may end up showing up as a pop-up on your computer for a number of months until you somehow go into your cookies and cancel it. But the ads itself are quite lucrative because it looks like a free trial offer, and you think, okay, that's great. Now, we need to keep in mind that the law is intended to focus on the needs of a reasonable common consumer. And not every consumer is a doctor or a lawyer or an accountant. And recognizing that, there are unfortunately a lot of people that are take advantage of these kind of offers because they are not aware of what they're getting into. We've also seen generic descriptors on third-party billing statements. They may be a bank or a credit card bill, but the descriptor is so non-descriptive that there's no way for the consumer to really know what it is that they're acquiring, and it shows up every month as a $9.95 charge, and they think, okay, well, I probably signed up for something, but they don't know, and it's not until after a couple of months that the consumer may really think, geez, what is it, and then try and initiate the cancellation process, and it's not always that easy because the credit card bill doesn't say what it is that they've acquired and who the company is that's sending them the free sample. As the committee members know, the Department of Justice Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section operates primarily on a complaint-driven basis, and that is we receive information from consumers, we log them in, and depending upon the type of complaint, the seriousness and the repetitive nature of the complaint, we will either assign it to a lawyer or an enforcement officer will handle it. Generally, it doesn't get to a lawyer unless we're finding a repetitive pattern of conduct. And what I've attached to my materials is an example where we received, in the course of 2009, 11 complaints about a particular free trial offer. And this was a Pain Vanish cream that was marketed as a free trial offer. And as an aging weekend athlete, a Pain Vanish cream sounds like a great idea, and particularly if it's free. But unfortunately, the consumer complaints that we got said that it didn't turn out to be free because if you actually ordered the free trial offer, a month later you would be sent another tube of this cream for $14.99, and then 30 days thereafter you'd be sent another tube of cream for $24.99 a month. Resulted in a number of complaints to our office. We initiated an investigation, and as you can see, it's quite difficult to find if you cull through the materials that the Pain Relief Vanish cream markets whether there's any reference to the fine terms of the contract, which are that you're going to end up being billed for this particular cream. We have entered investigations with a number of other states in these kinds of circumstances, and on page 3 of our materials, we describe what we ask for when we obtain injunctive relief. And most of the time what we're looking for is not only a refund to the consumer, but we want better disclosures to the consumer so that they know exactly what it is that they're getting into. If there's going to be a discounted plan, how long are the discounts going to remain in effect? At what point are they going to be billed? And how can they cancel the contract that they are entering into? Those are the things that we request when we obtain an injunctive relief, and it ends up being helpful to the consumer because knowledge is power. The Federal Trade Commission has looked into this, and as indicated on page 4 of my materials, they have 5 marketing principles that they believe should exist in all online negative option agreements, and that is that the marketers should disclose the material terms of the offer in understandable language. They should make the appearance of disclosures clear and conspicuous. That the offer's material terms should be clear and obvious to the consumer before they pay or incur a cost. And what we've seen in some circumstances is that the consumer doesn't learn about the terms and conditions of the offer until they put their credit card information and click on the button purchase. And then along comes a screen with all the terms and conditions, but you've already purchased it. The FTC obviously recommends that those material terms be disclosed before the consumer actually clicks on the purchase button. The marketer should obtain the consumer's affirmative consent to the offer, which means that they agree to the terms and conditions of the offer, and that there should be a reasonable method of cancellation equivalent to the method of signing up for whatever the product or purchase is that the consumer was entering into. The U.S. Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation did an investigation into this last May. And as a result of that investigation this past month, Senator Rockefeller has introduced legislation that specifically is dealing with electronic commerce, not dealing with telephone or snail mail solicitations. Again, the primary focal point of the legislation that Senator Rockefeller has submitted is better disclosures and better consent methodology for the consumer. I'd be happy to answer any of your questions, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Keith. We'll hear from Angela and then take questions.
Thank you very much. Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, Angela Martin with Our Oregon. And I have to say that I love the addition of the color behind you. It's very striking. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify on this issue. I also want to thank all the fine research done at the Department of Justice. As is often the case, they have covered many of the points that I've outlined in my testimony, so I'll leave those points to the written testimony. And instead want to make mention of a few of the tactics that are common in these sort of misleading sales, share some of the stories that we have gathered, and also offer comment to the work that's being done in Congress right now. Some incredible research being done there that should really help guide our efforts, but certainly hope it is not a substitute for the robust consumer protections that we can put in place at the state level. It goes without saying that a growing and vibrant online marketplace has been an economic benefit both to the retailers and a real benefit to the consumers as well. I certainly know that I'm among the 50% of adults who have recently made a purchase online or made travel reservations online and wouldn't want to see that go away anytime soon. But I also know you don't have to go very far before finding someone that has been offered one of these opportunities to stumble into a lifetime supply of a product that you never intended to purchase. Many of these transactions, such as the data pass, where you are in the process of completing a transaction that you're fully aware of. You are about to purchase flowers for your mother on Mother's Day. And in the middle of doing your checkout, you've put your billing information in, you've put your credit card information in, and then a screen pops up and says, would you like $10 off your next purchase? Of course, why not? So you push the button that says continue, just as you push that button to advance through every screen of the checkout process. However, by pushing that continue button and keying in your email address, so that you can get the email coupon to you, you've signed up for one of these products. What we're describing here is a process that defies consumer expectations. When a consumer is making an online purchase, most of us, and surveys back this up, believe that we don't make a purchase until we've keyed in our credit card information. And it's defying that expectation through a sharing of credit card information from the reputable company that you're making the purchase from to the third party that you're unfamiliar with that really trips consumers up. These schemes are not companies offering these, and there are three major companies that seem to be doing a lot of the online business, they're very aware of the consumer confusion. Again, I look to the research that was done in Congress, and we find that the internal data that they were able to get copies of shows that the companies involved in these schemes have been aware of the customer confusion and know that their paying members have little or no awareness of the company or how they came to be financially obligated members. This is certainly the experience echoed by one of the individuals who I was able to interview, and that is Catherine Danner from Ashland. Actually, excuse me, it's Andrea Conklin from Ontario. When collecting her story, she started off by explaining that she didn't even know how this company gained access to her bank account information or who authorized them to start taking money. And this wasn't a credit card transaction. This was actually an electronic transfer directly from her checking account. When she went through the process of attempting to cancel it, it took more than a month of runaround and hassle, and she was only successful once she got her bank involved to get that account canceled. All told, she lost $150 for services that she never used and didn't knowingly authorize. The next individual I was able to speak with, Catherine Danner from Ashland, Oregon, sums it up by saying three little clicks cost her $329 for some useless product that she thought she was trying for free. This was a tooth whitening product. She had recently used a tooth whitening product from the store and really liked the results. She had contacted her dentist and discovered that it was going to be perhaps a little bit more than she had available to pay, so this opportunity for a free service that is claims to be just as good as what the dentist can deliver was very enticing to her. She caught this after one billing cycle, so it wasn't a matter of her not being an on-top-of-it consumer. One billing cycle, and she saw two charges that amounted to $329. The free shipment actually arrived after her membership started. How did this defy her expectations? Well, every online purchase she's ever made before, she's received an email confirmation saying, thank you for making this purchase or signing up for our product. This was not the case with this particular product. And then the final story I'll share with you is from Portland, Oregon, and the weight loss product, Akai, that we see anytime that we go onto the Internet. Like every other story I've shared with you, this was an offer for a free trial membership. Defied their expectations. So this consumer signed up for it and lost a total of $300 before they were able to cancel their service. Certainly look forward to participating in the discussion about this state policy and what we can do to curb these practices. In addition to the recommendations that we've already heard, I would put on the table one other one, and that would be to look at how we can end the automatic credit card transfers. The idea that someone that I'm doing business with can share my credit card information with a third party, unbeknownst to me, certainly defies my expectations, and it's a business model that has caught up too many consumers in this type of scam. The last table that I provide for you in my testimony shows you how lucrative the partnerships can actually be for the first party or the reputable business that you're doing a purchase from, just to give you an idea of why this practice continues and is so pervasive. With that, again, I say thank you and answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Girard.
Oh, thank you, Chair. Actually, I need a little bit of background and knowledge here because I don't understand why we can't regulate pop-ups. And I know that the feds say you can't, state says you can't, but please tell me why we can't regulate pop-ups, because if anything is frustrating running a computer, it's getting a male enhancement drug in the middle of looking at history. You know, I mean, it just isn't something that just... Anyway. Whatever. But I do need to know why we can't deal with pop-ups at either the federal or the state level and what the problem is there.
Senator Bonamici, Senator Girard, part of the difficulty with pop-ups is that the companies that are creating them may be outside the United States, and so we wouldn't have any jurisdiction over them. Second, there's at least a reasonable argument that a company in Iowa may not be doing anything in the state of Oregon, so we wouldn't have any jurisdiction over them either. But that would then create a problem, even if we attempted to regulate the Iowa company, that would potentially create a problem with a violation of the Dormant Commerce Clause, in that we would be attempting to regulate activity that occurs in another state, and by imposing our regulation on a business that's operated out of Iowa that might also be doing business in every other state could result in a constitutional problem. I'm not sure why the federal government couldn't regulate it, and I don't know the answer to that.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I see the guidelines that you're proposing or that you already request when you get one of these complaints. Are there any sanctions if these companies don't do what you've asked?
Senator Bonamici, Senator Rosenbaum. Yes, the examples that I put in my materials are of provisions that we've obtained as part of an assurance of voluntary compliance. If a company fails to comply with them, we would then go back to court and obtain court sanctions for violation of this agreement.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. Since we first started talking about this issue, which was during either at the end of the 2009 session, we talked about it in the interim before February. I listen to the radio. I spend a lot of time in my car commuting back and forth to Salem. And I've heard quite a few free trial offers on the radio. So a point I want to make is that they aren't limited to online sales or even magazines. There are quite a few on the radio. And I've actually called a couple of the 800 numbers just to find out, ask questions and find out what happened. And a couple of the numbers that I called, there was no person. It was a recording, and it said, enter your, thank you for calling. You are one of the lucky 100 who get the free trial. Enter your address, enter your credit card number, name, address, and credit card number. Well, obviously, I didn't go to the credit card number stage, but at no point was there an opportunity to ask, and because I was on the phone, there were no disclosures. So is this something that you've run across with some of these companies, that there is never an opportunity to see a disclosure or to even ask, what am I getting? Because obviously, with the free trial, you think you're paying just for the shipping and handling.
Chair Bonamici, we've seen that problem in all of the different media contexts, whether it's over the phone, the internet, magazine inserts, magazine ads, and snail mail. It's very common that a consumer has difficulty getting clarification of exactly what it is they're acquiring and what the terms of the transaction actually are. And in the situation that you've described, and likewise in the internet situation, it's very difficult because they can create physical roadblocks for you to get any additional information. In your situation you described, you can't get a live human being to ask questions on the internet. If they don't have an FAQ page or a page where there are legitimate questions and answers that you can scroll through, you're stuck. You have no other options. So for a consumer that may not have the desire and the time to spend a lot of time scrolling through a website or sitting on hold trying to get clarification, they likely would end up with no understanding of the terms of the transaction that they enter into.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. We had a couple of consumers who were planning to be here. Carol Odenwaller, are you here? Gail Nelson or Lee Chanadry? No. Okay, what I'm going to do is the consumers are not able to be here today, but there is in our packet some information from Karen Garst. And Karen Garst was planning to be here. We had this on our agenda during the At the end of the February session, we were going to have a hearing on this issue, and because we were unexpectedly called to the floor, the hearing was postponed until now. But Karen Garst was prepared to give a presentation, and I will just briefly summarize it because it's an example of a free trial that she actually got some press about. Karen Garst is the former executive director of the Oregon State Bar, and this has to do with the situation that her son, who was at the time a freshman at the University of Arizona, had made what he thought was a free trial of Dazzle Smile tooth whitener. And he believed he was paying for shipping and handling, but in fact he was getting $79 a month charges to his Visa account. And apparently what happened was when he thought he was paying for the $2.95 shipping, there was a screen. I don't know if he actually saw this when he did hit the purchase button. In small font at the top of the page said, unless you cancel the trial after 14 days, your card will be charged $87.62 a month. Apparently this $87 was for a World Club Fitness membership that he had no idea he was enrolling in. And Karen had a presentation, which the committee members have in their packet, about how difficult it was for her. I don't know if she was a licensed member of the bar, but somebody who was working as executive director of the Oregon State Bar had a significant amount of time trying to assist her son in getting out of this transaction, and I believe it took her several months to finally reverse this transaction for what her son thought was a $2.95 charge to the credit card. So from the testimony and from the free trial discussion that we've been having, there are really a couple of different models. There's the type where somebody thinks they're just getting paying for shipping and handling and end up being sent every month some product and being charged for it. And then there's also the version where they think they're paying for shipping and handling, but in fact they're being enrolled in something oftentimes unrelated to what the free trial product is about. So the consumers were not able to be here. We do have their written information in the packets. There's another Smile Bright Dazzle White. There's another Berry Weight Loss, I believe. And then the third was a product that sounds like a vitamin called Resveratrol. So those were the three products that the consumer submitted. So our next testimony will be from Adam Grzebecki from AT&T, and I understand that there are other telecommunications people in the room or interested. Adam, if you want to come forward and talk about the concern of AT&T, and we understand that other telecommunications companies may have the same position. I will be having a work group on this issue. Our first introductory meeting is Thursday morning, so you're certainly free to come then. But just as a representative of the telecommunications industry, Adam, you want to go ahead?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Adam Grzebecki with AT&T. I was asked to come up today just to actually speak of some of the free trial promotions and services that we administer at AT&T. I actually didn't have a lengthy prepared testimony, but rather here to kind of answer some of the questions that you might have on our products. You know, AT&T offers customers actually just a select number of free trial promotions that enable customers to try out a service or a feature free of charge for a limited time, and typically that's 30 days for AT&T, and determine whether it's something they choose to retain as part of their wireless device or to cancel without penalty. Two examples that are probably our most popular free trials include the AT&T Navigator and the AT&T Family Map. AT&T clearly discloses the terms to these offers to customers and provides instructions when and how to cancel the trial before being charged. So again, this is based on some of the conversation we've already had today, and then you know, speaking on behalf at least of AT&T, and I'm assuming a lot of the rest of the telecommunications providers fall in the same way, you know, we feel that we are very clear and conspicuous in terms of the way that we outline our programs. Even just perusing the Oregon DOJ website, the Better Business Bureau, working with the PUC, and looking at the type of complaints that we typically get in, on our network in general, drop calls, billing issues, whatever you may have, very few ever filter in regards to our free trial promotions. So we haven't seen anything of significance to notify us that there's been a problem associated with the free trial offers that we administer. So with that, I'll stop and answer questions you may have.
Thank you. Any questions? Questions, Senator Burdick?
No.
Thank you for your testimony. And as Mr. Dabanovich explained in his testimony on behalf of the Department of Justice, there certainly is a place for free trials. And it's not the intent of myself or the committee to say that there's no appropriate place for it. We understand that it can be beneficial for consumers and good for business as well to offer those free trials. So we will continue this discussion. I know that many of you have already let Cheyenne know if you'll be participating in the work group meeting, which is it at 10 or 11? I forget which one is first scheduled first on Thursday.
Free trial is at 10 o'clock, I believe.
10 o'clock on Thursday. So we will continue the discussion at the work group meeting on Thursday. I do want to let the committee and others know that the state of Maine recently passed legislation dealing with free trials, primarily the model of the additional, oftentimes unrelated product that is billed. That seems to be the primary gist of the Maine legislation. I was unaware of any other state that had passed free trial legislation until I found out about Maine. So, all right, thank you very much for your testimony. Next on our agenda, we're going to be talking about debt collection issues, and this discussion is really divided into two parts, and I apologize for people who have to walk up and back twice, but I really want to keep these two discussions separate. The first is getting an update on Senate Bill 328, which was passed in the 2009 session, which gives the Attorney General the ability to enforce the State Unfair Debt Collection Practices Act, and to give us an update on that, I'm going to ask Keith Dabanovich and Jim Marquis to come forward, please.
Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Keith Dabanovich. I'm Chief of Staff and Special Counsel to the Attorney General. Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. As the committee is aware, Senate Bill 328 went into effect January 1 of this year, and the impact of that is to make violations of the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act also violations of the Oregon Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Prior to that time and passage of Senate Bill 328, violations of the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act were not pursued or enforced by any state agency. Since the beginning of this year, we have received 287 consumer complaints. 49 of them involve companies headquartered here in Oregon, approximately 17%, so a small minority. We've also received 32 complaints about debt buyers, and we may be not perfect on that number simply because we may not know precisely whether a company is or is not a debt buyer. When we look at the complaints that we get, we're able to identify some patterns of conduct which we then pursue as enforcement actions. Not all complaints that we get are violations of the Oregon Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. For example, if a debt collector is not calling during the specific time period, that's not a violation of Oregon law. And providing notice of the amount of the debt or something along the line of failing to respond to a request to communicate only in writing, that is not a violation of Oregon law. It may be a violation of federal law, but it is not a violation of Oregon law. Since the bill went into effect, we have done, I think, a very good job of outreach to both the community but also to debt collectors in the state of Oregon.
We've done this through a couple of things. First, we have a website, and on our website we have posted additional information about what is or is not permissible regarding debt collectors in the state of Oregon. The Attorney General made a commitment to Mr. Markey and his members to communicate with them, and indeed the Attorney General has met a couple of times in our office with Mr. Markey and the members of the debt collection community. He has attended at least one of their meetings. I think it was out in the gorge, if I remember. Two meetings. One was on the coast, I think, yeah. And we have sent our chief investigator to meet with them as well. And I believe that the relationship is quite good and working quite successfully, as indicated by the relatively small number of complaints that we've received about Oregon debt collection companies. We also have an outreach coordinator who travels the state to help educate consumers. And I think, frankly, we've done a pretty good job of getting the message out. And we are also communicating with the bar associations, including speaking at bar functions, to make sure that the lawyers in the state understand the changes in Oregon law. Since the law took effect in January, we have opened four formal investigations. In all four of these, we received many complaints about these companies prior to the law going into effect. And indeed, one of the companies had been on our top five offender list for many years. In two of the companies, we're coordinating efforts with other state attorneys general across the country, so it's a national problem with those two particular companies. And many of the complaints that we get allege harassing and repeated debt collection calls that are indeed in violation of Oregon law. The fourth case that we have is a matter involving a lawyer who acts as a debt collector, and we have had as many as 60 complaints about this particular individual and his firm prior to January of 2010. The current case that we're working, quite similar to the prior complaints, involves allegations of harassing the debtor after the debtor asks the collector to stop contacting them. So those are the kind of complaints that we're working at the present time. I think in the history of the bill, the relationship between the debt collecting community in this state, in the Attorney General's office, and our Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Office is quite good, and we appreciate the relationship that they have developed with us.
Thank you, and we'll hear from Mr. Markey and then open it up for questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim Markey on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association. As most of you probably know, the Oregon Collectors Association originally opposed Senate Bill 328 and weren't looking forward to additional regulation. But I must say that I echo everything that Keith has said. The Attorney General's Office, Mr. Dubanovich here, and Mr. Kroger and the other staff there have been just excellent to work with. We've had open communications. There's been no hidden agendas or playing hide the ball, and I couldn't be more pleased with the direction that they have headed. I remember the last meeting that we had with we established a committee to meet with the staff over there, and I had furnished them with a roster of our membership, and in the next meeting the staff members said we were absolutely blown away because you have all these members we've never heard of, we don't have a complaint on them. So again, I've been saying for a long time that this problem is not our members as much as it is some folks from out of state, and if Keith didn't say it directly, but the three investigations they have going on debt collectors are on out-of-state companies, I believe. And so that isn't to say that we don't have violations or particularly technical violations. It's hard to do this business without. But I'm feeling good about the relationship. I'm feeling good about where the enforcement is headed. And frankly, for our members, we ask our members to conduct themselves in a professional manner, and it's good for us if people operating here from other states do the same, and when they don't, we want them brought under control as much as you do. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Appreciate that. Thank you so much. Questions? Senator Gerard.
The question I had, and one of the concerns when this bill passed, would be that the exodus of Oregon companies that were somewhat of offenders. You're going to give me a funny look, but one out of six companies is an Oregon company under the complaints that you gave. And it's my understanding that if they're out of state, that's just that much harder to regulate. And so that some of the concerns were that there would be an exodus of debt collectors out of state with the firmer regulations. And that doesn't seem to be happening in any appreciable numbers or...
Chair Bonamici, Senator Girard, I'll let Jim answer the question about the number of his members, whether that's changed or not. I think it's important to put the numbers in context. We don't know how many cases that the debt collection industry is working today versus a year ago. So just in a general sense, I would expect that their numbers have gone up. So the fact that we've got 17% that are involving Oregon companies is not necessarily indicative of whether there's been a change in who's doing the collection. It's my impression that there has not been a substantial change in the number of businesses that are doing the collection in Oregon that are based in Oregon. What we have seen, though, is an increase in complaints involving debt buyers, and those, to a great measure, if not exclusively, are outside the state of Oregon. And I wanted to come back on your other point about whether there would be any difficulty in enforcing an action against the out-of-state companies. No, not at all. Indeed, the three of the four enforcement actions that we have are indeed out-of-state companies, and you know, if they don't cooperate with us, we'll just simply prohibit them from doing business in the state of Oregon, which, frankly, at the end of the day, is probably good for people in the state of Oregon. But we would rather work with them and get them into compliance, and it's quite easy for us to send a subpoena or a complaint outside state boundaries, and we have done that.
Can I just do one follow-up? Can you elaborate a little bit more, say that you have a complaint from out of state, and you find that they have broken a series of laws, and you just say, no, you can't practice in the state of Oregon anymore, but they refuse to cooperate and they still what jurisdiction do you have? Where's your hammer, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Chair Bonamici, Senator Girard, we would take a series of steps to ratchet up the enforcement power. The first is when we enter into an assurance of voluntary compliance, it provides us the ability to go into court to get the court to enforce the terms and provisions of the AVC. If a company based in Chicago violates that assurance of voluntary compliance, we would then go into a circuit court here in Oregon and say, okay, judge, they violated the law. We want you to impose sanctions upon that company. And the court may very well do it. The court could award monetary penalties. The court could award attorney fees. And then we would pursue the company to obtain payment of those penalties. We have worked with attorneys general offices in other parts of the country to facilitate the enforcement of local orders against those companies. And we've got a very good working relationship with other AG's offices, and we would certainly return the favor if they asked us to.
And I know Senator Burdick has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank the Chair for allowing me to ask this question because it is a little off topic. But yesterday, Senator Rosenbaum and I sat through quite a stimulating afternoon of hearings on various revenue issues, including delinquent accounts from the Department of Revenue. And we just ran out of time because I was hoping to drag Mr. Marquis up to the podium yesterday. But since you're here today, I thought I would ask both of you, one of the things that has been suggested is the possibility of expanding the role of independent collectors to go after delinquent accounts identified by the Department of Revenue. So I wanted to get your perception on what kind of an idea, and this would be in the area even including garnishment, but give them more tools than they have now under current statute, and you can elaborate on that, Mr. Marquis. But I wanted to get the some comment from the both of you, as long as you're here, on whether you think that's a good idea, and after hearing the testimony about in-state versus out-of-state, whether there's any legal way we could limit it to in-state people. I suspect not. But
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, first of all, I didn't finish with Senator Girard, and the number of Oregon collection agencies is the same amount, the same number today as it has been, so there hasn't been any change there. And I was in your hearing yesterday, as you know, and listened intently. What has happened with state collections, you know, Matt and I have been keenly interested in this subject since 1997 when Matt joined our firm, and his very first project was to bring me an inventory of state receivables and where they were and what agencies, and we found that none of the state agencies really knew how much their receivables were, with the exception of Department of Revenue. And so we've come a long way since then. There is a DAS went out with an RFP 6 years ago now, or almost 6 years ago, and to do state collections, and there were many collection agencies that bid that from across the country. I believe they issued 8 or 9 contracts. One of those was to an Oregon company, Professional Credit, out of Eugene, large collection agency here, and the rest were out of state. The pricing, you know, most of these people accept assignments and collect on a percentage of what they collect. So the people out of state bid it at a lower rate than many of the local folks did. And some of the local folks just thought the RFP was not something they wanted to bid on for a variety of reasons. And there were some things, some requirements and some hand-tying in the RFP that caused them not to want to bid. The problem is that when you accept these lower bidders from, I think the cheapest isn't always the cheapest, they will work because when they bid it low, they can't afford to work all of the accounts, so they work the easy ones, collect them, and let the tougher ones go and don't work them. So that's been a problem. But I just in defense of Department of Administrative Services, Gerald Floyd is in charge of that collection program over there now, and that 5-year contract is about to expire in, I believe, June of next year. And he is reaching out to our folks, and he and I have had several conversations. And he, his words, in many ways, we've been our own worst enemy by not approaching this in a more business-like fashion and not really utilizing the talents and expertise of some of the private companies that we could. So he had a meeting here in Salem about 3 weeks ago, invited all of our Oregon collection agencies in to get their advice about what a new RFP ought to look like. And we had a 3-hour meeting. It was a wonderful meeting. And he is looking at, a lot of our companies do pre-collect stuff where they're actually doing billings and that kind of stuff for people that not delinquent accounts, and then following up from there. And so he's looking at a much broader RFP this time around to try to bring a menu of services from the private sector that would be available to all state agencies, and then they could pick and choose from there, and the pricing structure would be, I mean, we're going to have some problems kind of figuring some of that out.
Madam Chair, if I could just interrupt you for a second. Is the Department of Revenue included in that?
This is a contract. This RFP will provide the cadre of contracts, contracted individuals or companies, that then each state agency picks from. And so the Department of Revenue would be no exception, and they could have 1 or 2 or 3 years. And actually, Department of Revenue is doing a lot of work with the Oregon company that's there. So those things, I think, are changing dramatically, and they should. We have over $2 billion in delinquent debt owed to the state now. And just as an aside from that, I would just say that part of the problem that I see here that I think we really need to create more emphasis on is that we always worry about how are we going to collect the money that's 5 years old or the debt that's 5 years old that's owed to the state. And at the time when we're worrying about that, these delinquent receivables are increasing at a what I would consider a somewhat alarming rate, maybe $100 million a year. And if we could reduce the increase in receivables by half, I mean, you just put $50 million a year in your pocket. Not that that covers the or takes care of the problem, but, you know, there's no rock where you're going to find $2 billion under. So my emphasis, I believe that the state ought to put a lot more emphasis on accounts receivable management systems within the agencies. And I don't believe that we've done a very good job as a state in developing a statewide accounts receivable management system that we require all agencies to undertake so that we know when an account is 10 days old, this happens. When an account is 30 days old, this happens. When it's 60, you know, and where certain things are happening along the way. And we don't have this situation where the debt is 10 months delinquent and the guy never got a call. I mean, we just can't have it. So,
for what it's worth.
No, that's useful information. I'd like to get your perception on if it's decided that, you know, it, specifically in the case of the Department of Revenue, whether more authority is needed. You've talked about having your hands tied. If the hands were untied a little bit, do you see a problem with that?
Chair Bonamici, Senator Burdick, in a vacuum, I don't think that there is a problem with assigning more debt to be collected by a private collection agency. I know that there are some complicating factors when you're talking about taxes, because you're dealing with a lot more confidential information than simply an account with XYZ company. So there would certainly need to be protections for the taxpayers, that, and there'd be, like it or not, there are going to be a lot more hoops for people to have to jump through to be able to do this kind of work for the state.
Madam Chair, Senator Berg, but there are collection agencies doing that work now, and those, I think those safeguards are in place. One of the things that I was referring to in my comment in the paper that you is that our collection agencies are experts at utilizing the small claims court when they find people that just are unwilling to pay or whatever, and they file small claims actions, for instance. Where no lawyers are allowed in small claims court, and if it's up to $7,500, you can file a small claims action. And the companies do that, and they get their judgment after, you know, the debtor has their day in court and all those things. But then you get your judgment, and then you can garnish a bank account or garnish wages or whatever if there's no response. And our folks are used to doing that for the private sector clients that they represent, and they're somewhat expert in it. We haven't been allowed to do that on behalf of the state. And if you want to garnish, and a lot of this stuff comes to you as a judgment. The judicial branch, for instance, all that stuff is judgment. So you have a judgment, you want, there's clearly there's a bunch of money in a bank account or whatever, you want to garnish it, you have to go back to DOJ. And then they actually, I think, issue the garnishment. And that's somewhat cumbersome and takes more time.
But in the private area, you can do that without...
Oh, absolutely. Do it every day.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for
You're welcome.
Me
that was,
pursue this line of questions.
No, that's absolutely fine. Interesting discussion. And you can stay right there because we're moving on to part two of debt collection. We talked about enforcement by the Attorney General's office, but there's also civil enforcement of our state's debt collection statute, and I'm going to ask Keith Carnes to come up. Some of you may recall that there was a Senate Bill 386 in 2009, which actually passed the Senate but not the House, that dealt with some of the civil enforcement issues. So I'd like to get in update, if I could, from Keith and the team of Keith's on issues that are still remaining in the civil enforcement side under our state debt collection statute. Keith? Either Keith? Give Keith Dabanovich a break and hear from Keith Carnes.
Thank you, Senator Bonamici and members of the committee. Again, my name is Keith Carnes. I'm an attorney in private practice. And I'm here in that capacity. I'm not here on behalf of any of the agencies or entities in which I'm associated. The issues that we see today coming upon consumers that are alarming and worrisome to both me and my clients and attorneys who work in this field are basically two that I think that the Senate bill from the last session attempted to tackle. The first is a problem of the reciprocal attorney fees. Under the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act, the party who prevails on an action isn't entitled to collect their attorney fees from the party who does not prevail. This is basically a situation where many of my clients who are looking to bring actions under this statute will come to me with lists and lists of people who keep calling them repeatedly and threatening them and trying to do anything they can to wring money out of these people. And by and large, every one of my clients wish they could pay these debts. They're not trying to get away with anything. They're not trying to be dishonorable people or take advantage of anyone. But when people are sick and they have a choice between paying an old bill or buying medicine, they have to choose to buy the medicine instead. And so we have clients who are coming to us, and in order for us to prevail on the repeated phone calls, we have to show that the debt collector communicated with the debtor or any member of their family repeatedly or continuously, or at times known to be inconvenient to that person, with the intent to harass or annoy the debtor or any member of the debtor's family. And how you establish that a giant corporation that has computers that are dialing out these people's numbers had the intention of harassing and annoying my client can be difficult. And so it's not that the jury would have to determine that my client shouldn't have brought the lawsuit. If the jury just determines that the bank, because of a computer glitch or some other reason, made all these phone calls instead of with the intention of annoying and harassing, then my client will lose that lawsuit. And as such, can be facing attorney fees on the other side of tens of thousands of dollars. And this can be a real problem. I have a client now who had the misfortune of taking over a cell phone number for somebody who wasn't diligent on paying her bills. My client, as soon as she got the cell phone number, inscribed the telephone number on her daughter's emergency contact bracelet because she had medical problems, inscribed it on her backpack, did all these things, and so she felt attached to this number. Her young daughter had the number memorized. But as many as 15 or 20 times a day, she had received phone calls because the prior holder of the number didn't have wasn't current on her car bill. During depositions, the car company admitted that the person who owed the bill was never more than 30 days late, and yet they were calling 15, 20 times a day, as many as 30 and 40 times a week, to collect a bill that wasn't even 30 days old on a person who said repeatedly, "This isn't me, leave me alone, don't call me here again." My client works for another attorney, and he wrote a letter saying, "You have to stop this. You're violating state and federal law. Quit calling her." And the calls kept coming in. It wasn't until we actually sued them that they stopped calling. And we now face this burden. And that's one that, in this case, we feel comfortable we can overcome. But there's a real risk that a person who has a legitimate claim won't be able to pursue it because of the risk that the attorney fees will be levied against them because of a failure of proof on intent, not on any other reason. The second issue that I think that should be addressed is the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act makes it illegal to collect or attempt to collect any interest or other charges or fees in excess of the actual debt unless they are expressly authorized by the agreement creating the debt or expressly allowed by law. And so it's illegal in Oregon under 646-639-2N to collect interest fees or charges that are not allowed. But there's nothing in there about principle. And actually, the Oregon Supreme Court has said it doesn't violate the statute to just make up a principle number that's incorrect and try and collect it. And this, to me, is a terrible shortfall in the statute, that unless my client can establish that the amount that they're trying to collect that shouldn't be charged comes from a fee, interest, or a charge, my client once again loses. And so with a few small changes to the loser pays provision and establishing a statute that would expressly forbid the unauthorized collection of principal, I think that the statute is very workable and does well. Under federal law and under many of the statutes that the state has provided recently in respect to consumer protection, the bill has allowed for the consumer to collect their fees if they're successful. And the debt collector, or the party who is the defendant in the action, can seek their fees if the consumer brought the lawsuit in bad faith and for purposes of harassment. This cuts down on the likelihood of frivolous lawsuits, because people can have sizable fees levied against them. However, people who honestly have a dispute, who just want some to be treated in a decent manner, not to be receiving calls at work, not to have their friends and relatives called repeatedly to collect a debt that they want to pay but can't, can make it stop. Because, to be honest with you, I have staff who will call creditors and say, you need to stop calling. They'll send letters. They'll do everything. And until we file suit, we have had very little success in making these calls stop. And so making these small changes would allow consumers to really enforce their rights in a way that will just buy them peace and let them be treated humanely and in a dignified manner. They want to pay their bills, but many of them just can't. And so I think with those changes, the statute is very good and very workable.
Thank you, Keith. Either of you?
Yeah, I'd like to add a couple of comments. This is Keith Dubanovich again, Chief of Staff to the Attorney General. There are two areas that we may have a gap in Oregon law, and that involves the identification of the original creditor and suits on unfounded or paid debts. Let me address both of those. And it may be exclusive to the context of debt buyers. We haven't been able to identify that precisely, but here's what we're having issues with. Oftentimes, a consumer will receive a telephone call and say, you owe XYZ amount of dollars to this company. And the consumer will have no recollection of that debt and say, okay, well, who are you representing? And the person on the other side of the phone will say, well, I'm calling on behalf of XYZ Collection Company. Well, the consumer doesn't have a relationship with XYZ Collection Company. They may have bought something from JCPenney. But the person making the telephone call may have acquired the debt third or second or fifth time over and not know that it's actually a credit card debt with JCPenney. So when they're trying to collect on the debt and the consumer doesn't hear that it's with JCPenney, the consumer, their reaction is, no, I don't know that. I never had a relationship with that company. So one thing that I think would be helpful to the consumers and possibly even for the collectors is for there to be a confirmation of who the original creditor is, so that everybody is talking about the exact same debt from the initial conversation on. There is a verification letter that needs to be sent out after the original contact with the consumer.
Prior to?
Could be both. But and that oftentimes will include verification of where the debt came from and who the original holder is. But the consumer, unfortunately, will get that call before they get the confirmation in the mail. And so we think it would be helpful to have clear delineation of who the original creditor is, even if that original creditor is no longer owed any money, because that's who the consumer thinks they did business with. The second thing is that there, because debts are being sold en masse by debt buyers and bought and sold, it's becoming more and more common that there are collection efforts that are made on debts that have actually been paid or were not owed by
Mrs. Smith, but because Smith is a common name, the collector may be calling Mrs. Smith on a repeated basis. And what that has unfortunately created problems for the consumer, because then the consumer feels like they're obligated to prove that they either paid the bill or that they never incurred the debt in the first place. So if there's one other aspect that the committee could look at, is making sure that when a call is made by a debt collector or a debt buyer, that they actually have a good faith basis to believe that the consumer that they are calling actually is the one that owes the debt.
Thank you very much. Jim?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, again, I want to say that we ask our clients operating in this state to be professional and to deal fairly with those folks that they're dealing with, and for the most part, I believe that they do. The issues that Keith brought up, I think, are fair to look at, and I look forward to having a good, hearty discussion about some of those issues as we proceed with the work group that you, have, Madam Chair, have put together. I would say that there is a requirement under the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, FDCPA, for debt collectors, third-party debt collectors, debt buyers, and attorneys doing collection work, those three entities. The law doesn't apply to first-party debt collectors. But there's a requirement under that for those three parties to send a validation notice initially before contacting the debtor. And that that initial validation notice gives, and Mr. Carnes may help us technically here, but that validation notice basically gives the debtor 30 days to dispute the claim. And then the debt collector may assume that the debt is valid debt if the claim is not disputed within 30 days. But in that validation notice, there is a requirement that the original creditor be listed, and our clients routinely do that. If there are folks out there not doing that, and Keith makes it sound as though there aren't, currently I don't believe there is a requirement for that in the Oregon law. Again, we're under the federal act. The attorney general doesn't have enforcement power over the federal law, so they would simply have to forward that to the Federal Trade Commission, who may or may not take action. I haven't consulted with my client about this, but I believe that we would be supportive of including that same kind of requirement in the Oregon law and give them the power to enforce that. I think that's we're doing it. For those that aren't doing it, if we want to give the Attorney General some enforcement power in that area, I think that's fine. As to some of the issues that Mr. Carnes has raised, I guess I'll look forward to, again, a healthy discussion about some of those. We've discussed many of them in our discussions on Senate Bill 386 last session. My concern about some of what Mr. Carnes wants to do is the increasing volume of actions being filed against my client for what I call technical violations or mistakes that they've made. And some of them seem to be more about attorney fees for the plaintiff's attorney than about protecting a consumer. And I'm really concerned about that, because as I expect my clients to deal professionally and deal fairly, I would hope that the plaintiff's bar does the same thing. And I would just, I mean, I will quote a judge from a recent case who said about this is the Rodriguez case, the judge says, the two nits to which Rodriguez's counsel points in are really poster children for the proclivity of some lawyers to seize on non-material minutiae in an effort to grasp the brass ring of attorney's fees that are awardable to successful plaintiffs under the Act. And that's the FDCPA. And what we're seeing more and more of is not saying Mr. Karn specifically, but what we're seeing more and more of are what I would say nuisance lawsuits where they know our clients will probably settle them because it would cost more to defend them than the settlement would. And as you enter into negotiations on some of those settlements, they get somewhat bizarre. And I would just, I'd read you, this is not an Oregon case, but a collection agency who had FDCPA claim, and the claim was that the debt collector had been mean to the consumer and said things they shouldn't have. And the plaintiff's attorney offer was to settle the claim for $4,000 with no reporting. And they wanted, and listen to this, they wanted two checks, one check made to the consumer and one check made out to the attorney. Those issues, except the amount and the distribution, were agreed to. The defense counsel countered with a $1,500 offer to the plaintiff and a $1,500 to the law firm, two separate checks for $3,000. The plaintiff's firm responded with $500 to the plaintiff and $2,750 to the law firm. The defense counsel then countered with $1,000 to the plaintiff, $2,000 to the law firm, at which point the plaintiff's lawyer said, how about $250 to the party and $2,750 to the law firm? So those are the kind, I mean, that's not having the consumer's best interest at heart. And those are some of the things that we're seeing from the other side. And frankly, I think we need to take a hard look at that, too. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I have just a couple. There was the talk about the validation letter, and yes. Then, Keith, I want to say
validation notice,
right? Is that sent by regular mail, first-class mail?
Yes, it is. I shouldn't say that. I don't know how it's sent. I'll have to find out.
Okay. What I'd be interested in is knowing how long after if the collection agency or the collector puts the letter in the mail, then do they start calling the next day? Do they wait a week? Do they wait 10 days? Is there a time period that they wait? Because according to Mr. Dabanovich's testimony, there are some people who are getting called before they get the notice. So I just don't know what the timing is. I mean, obviously you can't, your clients can't control the mail, the U.S. mail. But.
Yeah, the statute is 15 U.S.C. 1692G, which requires that within 5 days of the initial communication, the debt collector must notify the consumer in writing, which is sent by first-class mail, right, that they have the right to dispute any or a portion, the entirety or any portion of the debt. And that unless the consumer does so within 30 days, then the debt will presume to be valid. They don't have to stop collecting. The debt collector does not have to stop collecting unless the consumer says, I'm disputing this. And so they get to keep collecting until the consumer says, no, this isn't my debt. But the notice has to be sent out within 5 days of the initial communication.
Could I just clarify that? So the notice has to be sent out within 5 days of the initial communication so they can call first and then send the notice later?
Okay. Yes, right. Yes. And under 646639 of the Oregon statutes, subsection 2H forbids communicating with the debtor in writing without clearly identifying the name of the debt collector, the name of the person, if any, for whom the debt collector is attempting to collect, debt collector's business address on all initial communications, and then in subsequent communications it has to have other things stated as well. And so there is something very similar in the Oregon statute.
Thank you.
Chair Bonamici, in follow-up, the validation notice does not need to include the identity of the original creditor. It has to include the name of the creditor to whom the debt is owed at that time, which may be somebody completely different than the original creditor. It's only until after the consumer sends a written request for the identity of the original creditor that then the debt collector has to notify them who they originally owed the money to.
Right, so, and that's under the federal.
Right. So it could be quite a while before the consumer is ever notified of their debt to JCPenney.
Right. And another question about the case that you were reading from, Mr. Markey, about the allegedly mean debt collector and the little issues, and you talked about the negotiation on the attorney's fees. Where was that? Is that a federal case?
It was not an Oregon case.
Where was it from?
I believe it was Texas.
Texas. Okay, thanks. Any questions?
Yeah.
Senator Burdick or Senator Rosenbaum, any questions? No. Hold on just a minute. Let me just see if there's one. Oh, I have a question on the statutory damages in the federal act are $1,000. Is that correct?
$1,000.
Yeah. And in the state act, they're
$200.
And how long have they been $200?
A while.
Nineteen seventy-seven.
Was that when the act passed?
Yes.
Okay, so $200. Okay, thank you very much.
We always thought they were too high then.
I wonder if we applied inflation factor, what they would be now. I believe that's all for that issue. And interestingly, during that discussion, garnishment came up, and that leads us, it's a good transition to our next topic. And we have... We're going to have two panels on this topic, and first we'll hear from Sybil Hebb, Jim Corr, and Keith Carnes is going to come back up. And just while they're getting settled, committee members, ooh, it's going to be committee member in just a minute. Committee member, this discussion is a follow-up to Senate Bill 731, which we passed in the 2009 session. And I hope Senator Girard comes back because he was instrumental in the work group that worked on this solution when we'd heard about exempt funds being taken from bank accounts. There was a concern because, for example, disabled veterans or senior citizens would then have the burden to go to undo the transaction by filing a claim of exemption. So the work group got together and came up with this solution, and we're here to get an update on how that's going. So do you know who's going to go first, Sybil?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Bonamici, Senator Rosenbaum, and guests. My name is Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, and I want to speak a little bit about implementation of Senate Bill 731. Before I do that, I wanted to just express our great thanks again to the committee, to the chair, and to the other interested parties, I know many of whom are in the room, for their work in moving this bill forward. The issue of protection from garnishment of essential public benefits for vulnerable people is just of huge importance to our low-income clients, and the purpose of the bill is to provide really great protection for them. So we're appreciative of it. We're excited about making sure that it works across the state. I think the sort of general summary of our feedback today is that we're optimistic that we're off to a good start. We've got some work to do in terms of getting education and information out across the state. We expected that. That's to be expected anytime the law changes, and we're here to tell you a little bit about the efforts that we've been making to get that word out. I'll just do a quick summary, again, a refresher of the issue. I know Senator Girard and the chair and Senator Rosenbaum are all familiar with it, having worked so hard on it. But just a brief summary of the bill is probably a good refresher, and I think you have a one-pager in front of you or about to come around. And the bill applies only to seven types of public benefits. And those public benefits, when directly deposited or deposited by electronic transfer into a bank account, if they can be identified by the bank, either through an ACH code or through an affidavit filed by the customer of the bank, then the institution, the financial institution, must protect a 1 month's worth of those benefits. Amounts over 1 month's worth of the protected type of benefits can still be garnished. The customer still has the right to go and claim protection for that amount, but they must do that through a court proceeding. The automatic protection that applies up front only addresses 1 month's worth of benefits. The There is a release of liability in the bill that provides for no liability so long as there's good faith effort to implement the bill, the law, and then the law further specifies that when there is a claim of exemption hearing going forward about funds that have been garnished that the consumer thinks should be protected, they still have the right to do that claim of exemption, and the method of determining what is to be protected will be the first-in, first-out method of protection, which I think we sort of all the interested parties agreed was the sort of standard method that ought to be used. Again, we just really appreciate the bill and its purpose. Now the focus is really on outreach and education. We have an obligation to make sure that our clients understand what the protections are and how to avail themselves, and we're also interested in making sure that all of the financial institutions, both at the state levels as well as the local level in the communities across the state, have an understanding of how they can go about implementing the bill. That's really where the rubber meets the road in terms of ensuring that that protection works. And we very much appreciate the willingness of the financial institutions to sit down with us and talk about how we can best accomplish that. We've had meetings with the banks as well as with the credit unions. We've exchanged information about the types of materials that we're handing out. The banks had a manual that we were able to look at, which we thought was terrific, and so there are good efforts going on. We have, however, seen some examples across the state in which it's been clear that, you know, there's still a gap, and so there's still some work to do, and the sort of two themes of examples that we've seen, and we've shared these with the banks, and they've been very kind in offering to help us to try to resolve those. But the examples that we've seen are that either institutions don't know what to do with the affidavit when it comes in and are unwilling to accept it, and they're not aware of what they're to do with it, or in some circumstances we have seen benefits that ought to be covered by the bill have been garnished. I should make it clear that in every example I know of that's come to our office, we've been able to follow up and get that issue resolved, but we are just concerned about making sure that, you know, on a daily basis, there's enough information out there that it can be practically useful to everybody. So again, I guess I'll say that I think we have some work to do. We're off to a really good start, and we are hopeful that we'll be able to come back and report about further success down the line. Jim's going to talk a little bit about some of the specific efforts we've been doing in terms of outreach to legal aid clients. So,
thank you, Shibla.
Hi. Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. My name is Jim Kaur. I'm a staff attorney at Lane County Legal Aid and an adjunct professor at the University of Oregon School of Law. With the passage of Senate Bill 731, Oregon became the fourth state to enact legislation to protect exempt benefits from garnishment out of a bank account. And two other states have adopted court rules to do the same thing. The since the adoption of the bill, law went into effect January 1, we prepared materials, and I think you have the instructions for filling out the affidavit and a form affidavit that the legal aid offices in the state collaborated on and prepared. And we've made that available to the various agencies that pay these benefits in the hopes of getting that information to people who could be affected by this and who could benefit from the provisions, the protection afforded by this law. So we have an affidavit and instructions. The Credit Union Association also developed an affidavit form, and I know that in late January, when I checked with a couple of the local credit unions in Eugene, I learned that they did have an affidavit form that the association had developed. And the law provides that, and I'll mention also that Ken Sherman and the Oregon Banking Association also developed a form affidavit that they, not necessarily to be used by every bank, but as a sample, the banks could use. The law provides that there are essentially three ways that the funds to be protected can be identified. One, the financial institution may require an affidavit form at the time that a new account is opened. And then the law requires that financial institutions must provide a form to current account holders or new accounts. So they may require, but they're not required or they don't have to require an affidavit, but they do have to have an affidavit form available. And then the third thing in the law is that if the funds can be readily identifiable, whether or not there's an affidavit filed, then they're to be protected. Now, we, in addition to the affidavit form and instructions that we prepare, we also prepared a poster, and I'll just hold it up. I don't have a lot of copies. I do have copies if you enough for the committee if you want them. I've prepared a poster, and we've disseminated that and had that posted in DHS offices, Social Security offices, employment, veterans, the Veterans Center, Eugene Library, different agencies that work, Full Access Brokerage, ARP, Senior Companion Program, Public Defender's Office, and different places where we think we can try to get the information out to folks about this protection. There is some source of confusion, I think, and I think that the credit unions have corresponded with Sybil about this. There is some confusion about this law, and I think part of the confusion is the fact that people never really understood what was happening prior to the implementation of this law. They knew that their benefits were supposed to be exempt from garnishment, so they couldn't really understand when they found out that the bank had taken the money and paid it to the creditor, and they didn't understand under the old law that they had to go to court. And I know I naively assumed before I started seeing these cases that if somebody garnished my client's bank account today, we would file a challenge to garnishment and have a hearing maybe next Monday and get the money back on Monday. And what I found out was it takes weeks and really shockingly months in many cases to get the money back. And the bank fees that I was seeing were, you know, somewhere around $200, $300, $400 by the time they finally got the money back. So we appreciate the cooperation of the banks and the Credit Union Association in trying to implement this. And we've also, of course, put out information at all the legal aid offices, and we put a feature story on our website, and I know Legal Aid Services of Oregon has the forms available on their website. We've talked about the possibility of doing a public service announcement. I don't know if that'll happen. I did prepare a press release, and I've disseminated that somewhat. I think I might try to do that further dissemination of that, because I don't think it was widely picked up. We think that the information is really critical here, and one concern I know is that still people at the levy departments that I've talked with through the efforts of the Credit Union Association and the Oregon Banking Association, the levy departments know about the law, and the forms, of course, were revised to tell the levy departments what instruct them on how to follow the law, what procedures to follow. But I don't know that the bank personnel at the local branch office, certainly at the teller level, I don't think know about the law. So if a person comes into the bank or credit union and asks about it, my experience has been in dropping into a few branches is at least at the teller level, people don't know about it. At the account services level, people sometimes know about it. I did check with one of the credit unions today, and it was kind of one person said, I haven't heard of it, and they asked the person behind them, have you heard of this? And the person behind them said, well, I think I've heard about that, I'm not sure, and you know, they sort of huddled together. So we are a little concerned about you know, just making sure that the pieces work together, and I think we clearly need to do more in terms of creating a general level of knowledge about this law. There is now a proposed federal rule. When we testified about our proposal last year, we mentioned that there had been some discussion of this at the federal level. The federal rule was filed on April 14th of this year and is now within the 60-day comment period, which will expire on June 18th. Federal rule is somewhat different than the Oregon rule. We set, and I think it's Senator Girard's suggestion or help, we looked back at the current or at the prior month to determine what benefits were received in the prior month and protect that amount. This federal rule also has a look-back period. instead of protecting a flat amount, but their look-back period is 60 days. I predict that that will be changed if and when the federal rule is finally adopted, because that could protect 1, 2, or 3 months' benefits, depending on when the writ of garnishment was received. But the intent of the federal rule is to protect 2 months' worth of benefits. In theory, that would seem to be more favorable to debtors. In reality, I suspect it's not that much more favorable, because most folks relying on these benefits are living month to month and don't have 2 months' worth of benefits in their bank accounts. There is some overlap between the federal bill. It would protect Social Security, SSI, and veterans' benefits, but it would only protect benefits paid by federal agencies. And so, for example, it would not protect TANF and unemployment benefits, which our law protects. Those are federal programs, but the benefits are paid by state agencies, so they would not be protected by the federal rule. And the federal rule would not protect non-federal retirement benefits or workers' compensation payments. The I guess I'd just close by thanking you all again for your work on this. I think what I realized in seeing clients with this problem is that there was real hardship and real suffering as a result of the existing garnishment procedure. It wasn't nobody intended that when they enacted the procedure. It was very simple for financial institutions to comply with the previous procedure, because they simply paid over whatever amount was in the account and left it to the debtor and the creditor and the courts to figure out what, if anything, the debtor should get back. But in the meantime, the debtors were left without any funds at all. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. And Senator Girard was out of the room when we acknowledged his work on this bill.
Oh,
so now he's back, and
much.
We'll do that again. And Keith Carnes is here to add a few thoughts.
Yes, Keith Carnes. I'm an attorney in private practice. And one of the things that I have done for several years now is offer people who the term that lawyers sometimes use is judgment proof, people who cannot be garnished because their income is exempt. I've always offered them an affidavit of my creation for them to sign and pass on to their creditors and anyone they wish to give it to, letting them know that their bank account should not be garnished. The bill is an excellent beginning to do that. I think the biggest problem, as Sybil mentioned, is implementation. I had several clients that I actually had to print off a copy of the statute, have them take it down to the big national bank on the corner and say, you're required to give me this affidavit, and they still couldn't get it. And so it's been a struggle, especially in the early going, to have people receive the affidavit and have this process taken place. The good news is, as Sybil mentioned, the more difficult time is getting the affidavit lodged with the bank than it is actually having the money taken. I've had no cases of anyone coming to me where they had money taken from them or frozen when this happened, or after they had notified the bank that their income was exempt. The importance of this really can't be lost. I read through the proposed rule by the Treasury Department and Veterans Affairs that was just mentioned, and they made a finding that 64% of people on Social Security rely on this as their primary source of income. And so I'm aware of consumer groups who are asking that the Treasury rule be implemented at 65 days, so that way there's always 2 months' worth of Social Security that's being protected. But as was mentioned before, while this proposed rule would be a great benefit to many people, it does not protect the state benefits, which are encompassed in the state act and are very important to a lot of people. And so just because the federal rules are coming along, I don't think we should by all means stop what we're doing here. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions? Any questions? Well, thank you all for your work on this. And as Janet Jocelyn from the Credit Union Association and Ken Sherman from the Oregon Bankers Association are coming up, I want to acknowledge their work. I know during the work group there were a lot of people involved and a lot of outreach going on. So we'll hear from Ken Sherman and Janet Jocelyn. Welcome. Do you know who's going first?
Doesn't matter. Would you like to?
Go right ahead.
Just a second.
Okay. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sherman. I'm counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. And I'm here to talk briefly about two things. The first is our efforts to work on the implementation of Senate Bill 731. And secondly, about this new federal regulation that has already been discussed a little bit. We supported 731. We felt it was important. We saw a lot of frustration at the ground level in banks when we knew that funds that were in the account were protected, were exempt from garnishment, and yet under the previous law could be taken, and then our customer had to go through this whole process of trying to get that money back. We saw the frustration that generated, and we really felt that there had to be a better way. So we had a lot of discussion about how to make this work effectively, but I think we came out with a pretty good bill, and we've worked fairly diligently since the enactment of 731 to make as seamless as possible the reception of that new legislation within the banks. We put out a garnishment manual for our members, and this is something that we started about 25 years ago, because when I first started practicing law, the garnishment law was on a page and a half of the ORS. Now it takes about 60 pages, and this unfortunately didn't help to make it any shorter. It probably made it better. We actually held up the production of the 2009 version of this manual because we wanted to include information about Senate Bill 731, and I've attached to my testimony excerpts from our garnishment manual that speak specifically to Senate Bill 731. So when you have a chance, you can look through those and see our initial effort to educate our bankers about what this law is designed to do and what role we are to play in it. We also do recurring training for operations people in the bank, and it's the bank operations people who are not really the tellers at the front window, but the people behind the scenes that actually are the nuts and bolts of this from a banking standpoint. They're the ones that make the decisions about what funds go out on a garnishment and what don't go out. And so we do training classes for them at least once a year. We had one last November when, as you can imagine, 731 really featured fairly prominently in those discussions, and that was the same time that we issued our new manual. More recently, we had a meeting two or three months ago with Sybil and Jim and representatives of the Department of Justice and a couple other people, and we talked about how we're doing, and it was suggested that there were still institutions out there that hadn't gotten the message that we weren't at 100% compliance. And so following up on that, we issued, in fact, are now in the process of issuing, a bulletin. And I've given you a copy of that. It's entitled Garnishment of Ungarnishable Benefits Payments. And that bulletin speaks, again, to Senate Bill 731 and the responsibilities of financial institutions. It includes a couple of examples that Sybil provided to me of cases where we haven't met the mark. And so our effort to continue the education is an ongoing one. This bulletin also speaks to the second issue, which is the new proposed federal regulation. And I'm not going to get into a detailed discussion of how that differs from the Oregon version, but I think the fact that it's out there and it's likely to become adopted is going to keep us all very busy in the next 6 to 12 months, because there are some very significant, important differences between that proposed federal regulation and Senate Bill 731. Jim has already mentioned that there's a difference in time frame, the calendar month under 731 versus 60 days. Who knows where that will settle down, but that's going to create conflict there. It's interesting that the state law does a better job of protecting federal benefits payments than the federal law does, because the state law covers black lung benefits, and the federal law, for some reason, does not. I don't know whether they just overlooked that or what, but at any rate, they're not covered. One of the concerns that we will have is that under the proposed federal rule, we have much less time to respond than we do under prevailing state law, which has always given financial institutions 7 calendar days in which to respond to a garnishment. And sometimes you need the better part of not all of that period in order to do all the research you need to do and to fully respond to the garnishment. This federal regulation would require us to respond in some cases instantaneously, in other cases 1 to 2 business days. Another requirement of the federal rule that isn't in the state law is this would impose a new notice requirement on financial institutions to send a notice to the customer. And I'm all in favor of notice, but the bank is the guy that's sitting in their middle holding the pickle, and they're not benefiting from this garnishment. If you want to have a new notice requirement, it ought to be imposed on the creditor who's trying to collect the money as a cost of doing that collection effort. So we're going to make that comment to the feds during this comment period. Another thing that I found kind of amusing about the federal rule is that unlike the Oregon rule, which protects not only federal benefits but state benefits and even private, like retirement benefits, the federal law makes one giant exception for when this applies, and that is it doesn't apply to any debt collection on the part of the U.S. government. You didn't do that with the state of Oregon, but for some reason they think it's okay to take the last crust from the starving mouth of a Social Security benefit if you're trying to collect a federal debt, but not if it's the Department of Revenue or some private debt collector. So we think that's a little inappropriate. The important thing, I think, for us to realize as we go forward with this is there is a preemption provision in the new federal rule that will preempt any inconsistent state law, and it's going to take some careful consideration to figure out which parts of 731 are preempted by this new federal law and which parts are not. So we're going to put together a working group within the banking industry to submit comments to the feds on the proposed rule, and we would certainly be happy to be a part of any ongoing effort on the part of the state of Oregon to modify 731 as we find it necessary to do so to bring it into line with the new federal rule. I'll be happy to answer any questions when it's appropriate.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sherman. And we'll hear from Janet, and then we'll take questions. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm Janet Jocelyn, and I'm the Director of Compliance Services for the Credit Union Association of Oregon. And we were happy to take part in the work group last session in putting together a solution that's before us today and the updates to OS 18. We have, at the association, my role is to communicate changes in law, whether it's state law or federal law, to our credit unions and provide them analysis of operational changes that need to be made to comply with the laws, again, whether federal or state. This is no different than with any other law. We've had many lots of federal activity since the first of the year, especially with regulatory changes that we've communicated, and we utilize several different methods to communicate changes in any type of law, whether federal or state. With regard to the changes to the garnishment law, we provided 2 opportunities for training through web training, web-based training, 2 particular days early this year, January 4th, I think it was 5th, and provided training to roughly 63 credit unions. Now, we had have no way to estimate how many people we reached because only one person for that credit union needed to register. But I was fairly happy with the penetration that we made through those initial webcasts in training with respect to the changes. We've also provided, through our various publications, we have a weekly newsletter, monthly newsletter. We've provided information about the changes, what's requirements in general of responding to a garnishment, and also communications about the affidavit. The affidavit is something where the statute didn't provide us language for the affidavit, and I did take the liberty to write the text for our affidavit and did have that blessed through our legal department. And that was also communicated and sent to our credit unions with a compliance release that outlined the changes to the law very early in January. So we've done, in addition to that, I do a little speaking trip to chapter meetings. We've got various chapter meetings throughout the state, and credit union staff and management come together to discuss issues, and I have been kind of on the speaking junket promoting changes and helping to spawn awareness of the changes. So I feel that we've done a fairly reasonable amount of work up to this point. Are we done? No. We continue to train on the issues on an ongoing basis. We have, in addition to the affidavit issue, not having the language provided for us and making a stab at what the requirements would be, we also have certain, I'm not even sure issues is the right word, but certain issues, I guess I will call it, which I think is what I called it in my testimony. I'm not going to go through each and every one of those. I'm happy to ask questions if you have that. We do see a fair number of questions, but not so much as an awareness or an unawareness of the rules and what's required, but clarification of what the requirements are. And as has already been mentioned with the federal proposal now, I foresee some muddying of the waters and additional training opportunities to kind of get the word across in what the response is going to be for credit unions. And I will be writing comments to the Fed proposal on some of the same issues that Mr. Sherman presented.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there questions? Doesn't look like it. Thank you. I want to thank you both for your testimony today and for all your work during the session. A lot of times people think that all we do have in this building is conflict, but this is really a good example of people coming together to solve a problem. So I really appreciate your work on this and look forward to continuing to work on this as we watch what happens with the Fed proposal. So thank you again for your testimony.
Thank you.
Our final topic is called Options for the Homeowner Stabilization Program, Steps Taken and Current Status. So I'd like to have Lou Savage from the Department of Consumer and Business Services and Rick, I hope I say this right, Krager from Oregon Housing and Community Services come forward. We are expecting, and I want to make this clear, just an overview of what you're doing, not details about how the money is going to be distributed for foreclosure assistance, because I know it's too early in the process for that. And also, I want to let you and the committee know that Representative Stiegler has submitted some comments in writing that I wanted to make sure you received and the committee received as well. So.
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, my name is Lou Savage. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm really the setup man today because Rick Krager is the guy who's been pulling the heavy oar as well as his agency, the Oregon Housing and Community Services Agency. March 29th, the state of Oregon, through Housing and Community Services, received notification that it was a recipient of the TARP funds for our foreclosure relief. TARP stands for Troubled Asset Relief Program, and the purpose of the funds is to have programs and strategies to prevent foreclosure and to stabilize housing markets. Oregon's share is $88 million, and there's a very short timeline to submit the proposal. In fact, it's due at the end of this month. So Housing and Community Services has done a great job pulling together a team and quickly getting a plan in place to seek public input and to develop a proposal that the Treasury Department will approve, and we can get going with getting the money out to the community. The plan included receiving public input from communities across the state. We went and visited Bend, Medford, Eugene, Portland, and had some meetings in Salem as well. And a result of those meetings, some of which occurred with community leaders and others were public forum, the team got a lot of good information about the needs of various communities and how they differed depending upon what area of the state we were talking about. So now we are in the process of putting together that information and working on a proposal that will be submitted to the Treasury at the end of the month. And with that, I'll turn it over to Rick.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Rick Crager, Deputy Director for Oregon Housing Community Services. Thanks so much for having us today. And we provided a PowerPoint presentation that we did actually this morning in the Subcommittee for Human Services. So I am not going to go through all of that, Madam Chair, because I know you want more of a higher-level overview. But I think Lou summed up sort of the process and what we're doing at this point. Again, you know, $88 million sounds like a whole lot of money, and we're very grateful to be able to get this, but I think when you look at the foreclosures and the delinquencies that we're seeing across the state, I think as Senator Bates put it this morning, it is really sort of a drop in the bucket in terms of the support. Having said that, again, we're very excited about having this opportunity, and we are going to be putting our proposal forward to the U.S. Treasury on June 1st, which is next weekend. As Lou indicated, we've collected a lot of information, a lot of data. We have to provide to the U.S. Treasury a proposal on how we'll allocate the funds, and again, I won't get into the specifics of that. But one of the areas that I did want to touch base with you on is, as we look at this program, one of the critical goals for us is how do we help low and moderately low income Oregonians avoid foreclosure and keep their housing costs affordable? That's going to be the primary focus, and I really underline avoid foreclosure. I think there's a lot of misconceptions is that we get this money and we put it forward into the communities, and it helps someone stay in a home. And certainly that is always a goal, and that is a optimum result. But I think we all should face that there are many people that are dependent on jobs, and those jobs may not be coming back. So we feel like in part of our strategy, we not only have to look at ways to keep people in their existing homes, but also try to find ways that they can maybe exit gracefully and be able to get into another form of affordable housing. So part of our proposal is a two-tiered approach. In the PowerPoint that I provided you, and I'm a pitcher guy, and I'm not going to get into the details of that, but on page 12 of your presentation, it gives you sort of a quick overview of how all the money is going to flow, or at least how we're proposing it. Again, we look at this as a two-tiered approach. $26 million, which is, you know, focused on the left side of the graph, is really going to be working with a lot of the financial institutions across the state and trying to figure out how to make the existing home affordable modification program, HAMP, as I always call it, how to make that much more effective. That's been one of the common themes in all the forums that we've been at, is that it's just nearly impossible to really work with lenders and get through this HAMP modification process. So if there's a way that we can invest some of these dollars to really support the many people that are currently in the pipeline, if you will, of trying to get a modification and get an affordable mortgage long term, we want to do that. And the data suggests that if we invest $26 million at about no more than $10,000 a household, we would be able to do that. So with that particular program, we see about 2,600 households being served. The more comprehensive approach of our proposal would be $55 million, and that's on the right side of the graph starting at the top. And we see this as a more of a triage approach. Again, the focus of this money is on the unemployed, the underemployed. There's a lot of new people that are going to be entering the systems. And again, another common theme that we've heard is one of the most successful tools in helping people that are facing foreclosure or in delinquencies is counseling. And right now, if you look at our counseling systems across the state, they are working extremely hard and very much understaffed. So part of this proposal would be investing into foreclosure counselors and giving them opportunities to help and be a point of contact for homeowners owners as they come into the system, and then being able to give them a toolbox. And that's what the far right column there shows, is a variety of different strategies that we would use, or the counselor, I should say, would use in helping them. One of those is mortgage payment assistance. This was a common theme that we heard in Bend. People need time. People are 90 days delinquent. They're getting foreclosure notices. If we can maybe provide some form of short-term assistance where they can get back on their feet, get a job, maybe they can either get modified or be able to maintain their mortgage as it was before. So that's one particular tool that they could use. Another one, again, and similar to what I spoke about with people in the system, is how do we use the money effectively to get loans modified? So a lot of people come into the system, they're unemployed, they get a job, but they're not making what they made before. And so how can we restructure that mortgage to be able to help them for the long term? And that's really what the Loan Preservation Assistance Program is about when we're investing $20 million. And then finally, as I said before, there's different ways of looking at success. We're trying to prevent the foreclosure. And to the extent that people aren't able to get employment, they aren't able to keep their existing home, we want to help them with transition. What can we do to salvage the credit so that at some point maybe they would be able to come back and become a homeowner at some time in the future? But at this point, maybe it just doesn't work. So those are kind of, in a nutshell, how we propose seeing the dollars flowing. One last thing I will say, and it's just referring to the last page on page 16, so you can just get a little bit of idea of the results that we are anticipating. On page 15, some of the key outcomes that we are anticipating. We're looking at about 6,230 households will be able to serve with this money. Again, when you look at foreclosures and delinquencies right now, foreclosures and delinquencies that are 90 days plus, we're about 40 to 50,000 across the state. So 6,230. And it's a good amount to help, but you can get an idea in terms of the how far we'll be able to make the dollars go. But again, we see being able to help about 1,000 households with short-term assistance that would enable them to get the time they need to get restabilized and hopefully be able to maintain their existing mortgages. About 3,600 households that would be able to get some form of modified loan going forward. We are trying an innovative approach, particularly in the areas of Deschutes County and Jackson, where we've seen high underwater, where the values have really dropped out. We're trying to come up with a program where we can be creative and potentially buy these loans out at deep discounts. That's going to be a negotiation between the organization and the banks to see if we can take over those loans and be able to maintain the mortgage for them. So that's about 330. And then finally, 1,300 people is what we're estimating with transitional assistance. Last thing I'll say is we're going to leverage this program as much as we can. Part of this and what we're encouraged to is really working with the banks and financial institutions and what they can bring to the table in the form of principal payments, extended forbearances, forgiveness. That'll be one of our big challenges, and I think that there are a lot of banks that are reaching out. The Bank of America, I should note, has been a very big contributor forthcoming in trying to look at ways that we can leverage these programs. So with that, Madam Chair, that's my quick overview. Again, June 1st is our date for delivery of the proposal, and hopefully we'll be able to get something happening here before the end of the summer. Thank you.
I have a question about, I think it's on your data and your allocation team. How are you deciding which geographic areas you'll focus on or wait the...
Excellent. Madam Chair, excellent question, and this has been a big part of what we have been working on. On page 7, it talks a little bit about the work of the data allocation team, and one of the guidelines in the U.S. Treasury, the guidelines they provide us, is that a substantial majority will go to the hardest hit counties. And as I mentioned, 16 counties were initially identified, and that's on a map on, I believe, page 3. That gives you an idea. Those that were 12-plus percentage. So there were 16 counties that were identified. They won't tell us exactly what they mean by substantial majority, so they're leaving it to the state to come out with the best way to distribute this. We believe that certainly unemployment is important. But we also think there are other variables that need to be considered as well. And those are listed for you on page 7, not only the unemployment rates, but the change in unemployment over the last 2 years, who's been hit hardest with the downturn of the economy. Foreclosures and delinquencies, obviously, is another indicator that needs to be looked at closely. And certainly the decrease in housing values. So those are all factors that really, from our opinion, define economic distressed areas. So when we went in and we factored that, and there's a lot of data, and I apologize, Madam Chair, on page 8, but it gives you an idea of what all those indicators were, and we came up with what is called a housing distress index to really determine who was all above state average. When we did that, funny enough, there were 16 counties that fell above the state average. 4 of them were new counties that weren't under the initial proposal of the U.S. Treasury. Those were Marion, Multnomah, Yamhill, and Clackamas County that were added. And so what we're going to propose to the Treasury is that we want to define hardest hit for you. We believe we'll honor the first 16 counties because, again, those were in the initial proposal, but we want to add the 4. So we're suggesting 80% of the resources go to those counties. It's highlighted on page 9 in the map. You can see where it would go. The other 20% would go to the white areas of the state. Just so you can get an idea, that 80% represents about 73% of the population. So roughly you're relatively close. A substantial majority, I guess, if you will, would be 80% of the funds going to 73% of the population.
Thank you. Very helpful. Questions? Any questions? I guess not. Thank you very much. When I learned that your final report to the Treasury is due on June 1st, I wanted you to hurry so you can go work. Sorry, we took your time. Well, thank you very much. I know you said you had a presentation this morning, and I believe you have another one tomorrow. Hopefully then we'll let you get back to get your presentation to the Treasury. So thank you again for being here. Appreciate it. Before we close the hearing, I wanted to just announce again, in case there are new people here, the work groups on Thursday from 10 to 11 is the work group on the free trial issue, and from 11 to 12 is the work group on debt collection issues that were identified today. So please let Cheyenne know if you're interested in participating in either of those work groups. Obviously, with just an hour apiece on Thursday morning, we won't have time to get into substance, but more issue identification and making sure that we have all the interested parties around the table and set a schedule for the work group discussions. So thank you all, committee, and we're adjourned for the day.